I'm Amelia Mola-Schmidt, and you're listening to In Conversation with Radio Laurier. Across Canada, many major cities have declared that mask wearing is mandatory in indoor public spaces as an attempt to slow the spread of COVID-19. Toronto and Peel launched this bylaw on July 7th, and the region of Kitchener-Waterloo is set to roll this out on July 13th. Although an important stride made in regards to public health, what does this mean for racialized groups who face prejudice and societal discrimination because they are following mask protocol? Dr. Jasmine Zine, a professor of sociology at Wilfrid Laurier University, is looking into just that. We sat down and talked to her about the racial politics of mask wearing and how racialized citizens are affected differently by this. Dr. Zine, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time today. Can you tell us a bit about the research you have been conducting on the racial politics of mask wearing in the coronavirus pandemic?
Well, I was actually writing about this for a special issue of the journal Topia of the Canadian Cultural Studies. And there's a special issue being edited by two Laurier faculty, Dr. Penelope Ironstone and Dr. Greg Bird. And so I was writing about this idea of the politics of masking, and the academic version of my article is coming out in that special issue in a couple of months' time. But I thought it was really important to put some of those ideas out in the public sphere as well. So what you read, I wrote as an op-ed. Mm-hmm. And I guess for me, when I first started to consider the racial politics around mask wearing, one of the first things for me was really the hypocrisy in relation to Quebec's policies about banning face veils in Bill mm-hmm. 21, and the fact that Muslim women are now, who cover their face, who wear the niqab, and it's a very small minority of Muslim women who choose to do that, but that practice has been outlawed, while at the same time, everyone else is being told, to cover their face. And so there was a certain amount of hypocrisy around that resonated with me because my work is actually on Islamophobia in Canada. So that was the first thing that caught my eye around it. And, I also talked about in France, there's similar policies there that have been in place for a very long time, that it's the same sort of phenomenon. And so that was one of the first things that caught my eye. And then I started to read articles about Black men who, when they wear a mask, feel often reticent to be out in public because of the racialized depictions and negative stereotypes of Black men and criminality, and that made them feel vulnerable wearing a mask mm-hmm. and going out in public. And then third was the issue of a very prominent issue of the hate crimes against Asians, and how really the image of an Asian body wearing a mask became very emblematic in this pandemic, mm-hmm. and that act of wearing the mask by an Asian body absorbed different meanings that were very historically entrenched about various types of anti-Asian racism that came up also around the SARS epidemic, mm-hmm. and how there has been a racialization around the virus itself, and that gets mapped onto Asian bodies. And so mask wearing for Asians as well becomes a problem and a consideration of when they go out having to deal with sort of public backlash, violence, harassment, and so on.
Mm-hmm. Now, I just want to touch on specifically the Asian population and the issues and hate they've been facing throughout this pandemic. Do conspiracy theories that have been circulating throughout the pandemic, such as the false notion that the coronavirus was manufactured in a Chinese lab, Trump has been calling it the China virus, does this kind of rhetoric play in to the prejudice and judgment members of the Asian community are facing while wearing a mask?
Absolutely. I think, with conspiracy theories, they tend to circulate quite a bit. There's a lot of fake news. There's a lot of, you know, far right media and so on. And somehow, you know, in many ways, some of these ideas are also taken up in the wider public sphere because they tend to circulate with a certain amount of impunity. And, you know, people are looking right now for scapegoats or what, you know, Stanley Cohen talked about as sort of the folk devils that become the repositories for all, you know, blaming them for all sorts of social ills and problems in society. And during this pandemic, Asians have become that sort of folk devil that is being blamed as pandemic starters, as, you know, people who are foreigners who are spreading the virus, you know, in Canada and in other nations. And so definitely the kind of hate mongering and rhetoric that exists. And it's, you know, but it's not just in those circles, right? I mean, I think, you know, if you go back to the representation of Asian bodies during the SARS crisis, and there's been some reports and articles written about that. One of the things that they found that I talk about in my larger academic piece on this topic is that, you know, the image of a masked Asian body was the dominant representation in a lot of media. So that association between, you know, sort of disease and Asian bodies and viruses being spread and so on, you know, has a longer sort of history in terms of how pandemic imaginaries construct particular kinds of bodies. But of course, you know, the kind of backlash and anti-Asian sentiment in North America goes back at least 100 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the concept that you mentioned in your article, mask tipping. Can you explain the origin of this a little bit more and what the implications are of this practice?
So the sort of project around mass tipping, or this sort of, you know, there's a sort of a community campaign that developed among, I think it was in Illinois, among some Black clergy and in cooperation with their local police, suggested that when people who are wearing masks enter a store, that they tip their masks so that whoever's behind the counter or shop owners or whatever can see them and don't perceive them as a threat. And this idea came from some of the Black clergy and some who actually were fearful for their own family members. One of them mentioned that they actually told their son, when you walk into a store, put your mask on when you go in, so that they see you first and know that you're not a threat. And so this practice, you know, is really, it's problematic in the sense that it's a kind of self-surveillance, right? It's sort of telling racialized bodies, you need to prove yourself as being innocent first, right? You need to prove that you're not a threat. And that kind of self-surveillance, you know, is something I'm familiar with my own research on Islamophobia and how that's affected Muslims who must sort of also self-surveil because people perceive them, you know, in a lot of, you know, negative ways as potential threats to public safety. And so there's a way that people then internalize that and become self-surveilling and have to be cognizant about how others are going to see them and how your body resonates in different spaces. And this is, of course, a very profound issue for Black bodies, especially Black men. I mean, we look at what's happened, you know, that's galvanized the Black Lives Matter movement, the police brutality and violence and murder that's happening. But also, if you recall, there was a case where there was a Black man who was in a park just simply, you know, walking and watching birds and a woman there, you know, found him, you know, threatening and then called the police. Yeah, yeah. So this idea of bodies out of place and how you need to, as a racialized person, be aware of how your body is going to resonate in different spaces, right, is where out of that abundance of caution, this idea of mask tipping was introduced through this sort of program that they had in Illinois.
Now, would that not, I'm just assuming that, would that put them at a larger health risk than people who typically don't have to mask tip because, you know, they are white?
Well, the practice was suggested for everybody, but the impetus for it came because of anti-Black racism, right? And and the deadly consequences of that. So, well, they weren't only suggesting it for members of the Black community to do this, or Black men, but the idea that it came from, the impetus of it came from that fear.
Yeah.
Of how, you know, Black bodies are perceived if they are wearing a mask, and that that would appear threatening. And, you know, and so understandably, there's a sense of caution, you know, built into that. You know, part of what I was trying to do in that op-ed and the article that I've written is to contrast, you know, the way in which masks are worn by racialized bodies versus the sort of privilege that goes along with mask wearing if you're white, where you don't need to think about that. You don't need to think about, well, how are people going to perceive me if I'm wearing a mask? You know, if I go into a store, if I'm somewhere, will people see me as a threat? Or if I'm in Quebec, will I be breaking the law if I'm wearing this as Muslim women? You know, face, or will I be blamed for starting this pandemic and seen as, you know, my body now represents, you know, instead of being something that is viewed as wearing the mask as being kind of part of a pandemic social contract where we are performing ourselves as good citizens who care for public safety and care for our health and others, and that this is, you know, sort of part of a good liberal citizenship, that kind of those sorts of values, social values attached with wearing a mask, aren't guaranteed if you are a racialized body.
There was a quote that really stuck out for me in your op-ed, and said the COVID-19 mask is a barrier to transmission of the virus, while the niqab is a barrier to social inclusion, specifically when it comes to Muslim women. Can you elaborate on the differences between these two different face coverings a little more? I know you touched on how the mask is like a social contract and how we all agree to do this for the greater good. But I think it's a really interesting and important point that you bring up about this hypocrisy that Muslim women are facing, specifically in Quebec with Bill 21.
Yes. I mean, you know, so if you're wearing a mask, and if we see this as a kind of pandemic social contract that, you know, gestures to the fact that we are concerned for the greater public good. However, when we contrast that, so it's a sign of, you know, it's a barrier to transmitting the virus. Mm-hmm. But for Muslim women, you know, it's being made as a barrier to their social inclusion, right? Mm-hmm. The niqab, because they cannot wear it in the public sphere. You know, so it becomes for them a barrier, whereas for, you know, to their inclusion and full rights in society and their bodily integrity and the ability to decide for themselves how they want to represent themselves, you know, in the public sphere. And of course, that whole case is very much structured around particular beliefs of around secularism and how it should be, you know, maintained and regulated and policed. However, it's been very disproportionate in its effect on Muslim communities, and particularly visibly marked Muslim women who are being told what they can and cannot wear, you know, by the state, and what the consequences are for them if they violate that. You know, and it's ironic and hypocritical that at the same time as they're being told that they cannot cover their face, that other people are being asked or mandated to wear a face cover.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we're looking at the differences between 2003 and SARS and now the COVID-19 outbreak, are there any differences or similarities between mask wearing culture? Is this kind of the first time we're seeing the emergence of the differences between Asian communities wearing masks and the assumptions that we make with them versus Black communities and Muslim communities? Were we seeing a lot of those similarities now in SARS?
I'm not aware of research at that time that was done on mask wearing as it pertained to bodies other than Asian bodies at the time. Mm-hmm. When it comes to, you know, Asian bodies going from 2003 to the current pandemic, there is certainly a continuity in the kind of racial backlash that the Asian communities have received, the toll it's taken on businesses, and even, you know, and then various kinds of hate crimes that have escalated, not just in Canada, but in, you know, across North America and other places. So where, you know, that there is definitely a continuity. And I haven't really looked at, you know, whether the statistics are the same or not. But nonetheless, there it definitely has been, you know, a kind of scapegoating that continues. And again, that is that construction of sort of the pandemic folk devil who becomes stigmatized and becomes the repository of all sorts of, you know, racial fears and angst about contagion. And that certain bodies get associated with contagion, how the disease becomes racialized and then associated with particular bodies is really what we're seeing, you know, within the Asian community and how they're experiencing this particular pandemic in ways that were similar to the SARS crisis.
Now, I know in the op-ed, you talk a lot about the media coverage of COVID-19 at the beginning and how so many images that were shown were Asian people wearing a mask when they talked about new outbreaks and how this kind of becomes our point of association. And you also, there's a link to another article in Vox where a photographic journalist gets interviewed and she talks about the responsibility of the media to portray how all diverse communities are shifting and adapting to following pandemic control. Now, do you believe that the media has gotten more inclusive and less prejudiced when it comes to the imagery used in the pandemic coverage since March?
You know, I haven't done a survey of the imagery that the media is producing around that. You know, so I can't really say that if there has been a shift around that. I think what we are seeing is a lot more people from marginalized, racialized communities writing and talking and speaking about their experiences. You know, to temper what might be some of the dominant discourses and fears. So we're definitely seeing more people writing. Many of the articles that I cited in that are from, you know, for example, from Asian scholars who were, are Asian journalists who were documenting this. So I think that, you know, when we have a certain archetype that's constructed, it has a way of filtering into the public imaginary in ways that are can have very destructive, you know, outcomes. And so what we're seeing is a lot more information about people speaking to what they've experienced on the street or in the bus, the kinds of exclusion, the kinds of daily microaggressions. And that's only what we hear about because so much of that doesn't get reported. But there definitely is a connection between what people are consuming and what kind of information is out there. If there is, you know, always that association between, you know, the mask wearing and contagion and disease when it's associated with it with Asian communities, that's a very difficult kind of imagery to dislodge.
Absolutely. I think it was in the Vox article that you cited where I think they were talking about Manhattan's first case, and it was a photograph of an Asian man wearing a mask in Queens, not even in Manhattan. And I think the first case, it said in the article, it came from a woman who had been to Iran.
That's right. And, you know, the stock photo images exist from since the SARS crisis, right? Because there was, you know, so many of those. There actually was a study done at that time that looked at the media representation in Canadian media and how many images were shown with Asian people wearing masks when they were reporting about SARS. And so there was a very high incidence at that time. There has to be, I think, another study, comparable study done now, looking at the same kind of imagery since the coronavirus pandemic to see if there's a consistency with the way that that particular imagery is being deployed.
For sure. And just to wrap it up here, one final question for you. Yesterday, the Regional Council in Kitchener-Waterloo voted on the bylaw to make masks mandatory in enclosed public spaces starting on July 13th. How do you think this is going to affect racialized members of the community? Do you have any kind of overt concerns right now with this decision being made?
Well, I think from a public health standpoint, I think it's very prudent for people knowing what we know about the transmission of this virus to, you know, maintain all the protocols, and that includes wearing masks. But I think even before, you know, this was mandated, you know, as I mentioned in the article, there were people who, you know, thought twice, racialized people in putting on the mask, and then had to have that conversation with themselves about, you know, do I wear this and then go out and face harassment. In fact, after the op-ed, one of my students, former students, mm-hmm. Who is Asian, actually emailed me to say that that was actually her dilemma. Wow. You know, that she had to worry about whether she puts this on and goes out and then has to face, you know, sort of a kind of public backlash or microaggressions or harassment versus, you know, going out and not wearing it and then being susceptible to the virus. So this comes into the kinds of equations that racialized bodies have to make mm-hmm. when they go out and you know, wear a mask. And so that is always going to be on the table and always part of, you know, what they have to consider in so doing, because there's a threat in some ways to wearing it, and then there's also the threat of not wearing it. And again, as I go back to my, you know, sort of our central argument around this was that also for white bodies, those aren't part of the calculus that they have mm-hmm. to make in going out, in terms of, you know, how will I be perceived by others? How will my body be read by others? There's a certain privilege, you know, we talk about white privilege. There's also a white mask privilege mm-hmm. that goes along with not having to ask those questions, not having to do that calculus, and being able to go out and just be seen as the good liberal citizen mm-hmm. who is there to uphold, you know, the social contract that we have during this pandemic to look at public health and safety and to monitor our behavior accordingly. However, you know, there is also a underwritten racial contract in society whereby those rules don't apply to everybody. Mm-hmm. Especially for racialized communities, the same rules don't apply.
Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Z. And this is a super important piece that you've put out, and I'm looking forward to reading the fully published one when it's out soon.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
In Conversation with Radio Laurier is written and produced by Amelia Mola-Schmidt. The song that we use is called Loopster by Kevin MacLeod. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.